Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to take complex subjects, really dig into them, and pull out those crucial insights, the ideas that give you real leverage in understanding how things work.
That's the goal. Today, we're diving into something called systems thinking. Specifically, we're looking at mental models.
Right. And this isn't just academic. Our mission today is, well, it's intensely practical. We want to equip you, the listener, with tools to better see, anticipate, and maybe even influence what's happening around you.
Exactly. It's about upgrading how you think, moving beyond just reacting to stuff and starting to see the underlying structures, whether that's in your career or in the market or even big historical shifts.
Okay, let's nail down this term first. Mental models. Because it sounds a bit abstract, but it's really fundamental.
It is. Simply put, a mental model is your internal representation of how something works. Think about it. The world's incredibly complex, right? We can't possibly track every single detail all the time.
Information overload.
Totally. So we develop these simplified concepts, these rules of thumb, these models to make sense of it all. They help us store knowledge, predict what might happen next, and just generally navigate without getting stuck.
Like chunking patterns, you mentioned. Grouping information.
Precisely. And the real power, the leverage, isn't just learning new models, although that's good too. It's about applying a model you understand in one area, say, finance.
Like compounding interest.
Yeah, exactly. Take that idea of compounding and apply it somewhere else, somewhere less obvious, like your personal habits or building professional relationships. Suddenly, you see growth potential you missed before.
So it's about cross-applying these core principles.
That's where the magic happens. When you start doing that, you see the hidden levers, the invisible barriers that other people just don't notice. And that helps you avoid costly mistakes and jump on opportunities.
Makes sense. So for this deep dive, we're focusing on four really foundational models, ones that seem to pop up everywhere.
Yes, four that are deeply interconnected: feedback loops, critical mass, bottlenecks, and compounding. They really govern how systems change, grow, and sometimes break down.
All right, let's start with the first one, the absolute engine of change in any system.
Okay, feedback loops. This is the core concept. A feedback loop happens when the output of a system that the information it generates circles back around and influences its own future behavior.
And it's happening constantly, right? Whether we notice it or not.
Constantly. It's inherent in any dynamic system. Life itself is feedback loops.
And that output, that information, it's not always numbers on a screen, is it? In our daily lives, it could be much subtler.
Oh, absolutely. Think about a conversation. The feedback could be a slight change in tone. Maybe someone looks away. Maybe they don't reply to your email. That's all information.
And that information immediately shapes what you do or say next, which generates more feedback. And there's your loop.
Exactly. And this actually highlights something crucial about our personal lives. The people closest to us, say your inner circle of friends or family, they matter immensely because they're the source of the most consistent, high-quality feedback.
They reflect our actions back to us, constantly shaping our choices through their reactions, their approval or disapproval.
Which is why who you spend time with has such a huge impact on your outcomes. It's a powerful feedback system.
So to really understand any system, you need to figure out which type of feedback loop is dominant. There are two main kinds.
That's right. Two fundamental types. First, you've got balancing loops. Think of these as stabilizers. They work to keep a system around a certain goal or target state. They seek equilibrium.
The classic example is a thermostat, right?
Perfect example. The thermostat measures the room temperature. That's the output. If it drifts too far from the set point, the goal, the system kicks and turns on the heat or AC to bring it back. It's balancing.
Our bodies do this constantly too, don't they?
Mm.
Homeostasis. Keeping temperature, blood sugar, all that stable.
Exactly. Balancing loops are essential for stability, for sustainability. They resist change in a way. They want to maintain the status quo.
Okay, so that's one type. What's the other?
The other is the reinforcing loop. Now, these are the accelerators, the amplifiers. The output feeds back in a way that strengthens the original input, pushing the system further and further in the same direction.
These sound like they can get out of hand.
They often do. They're inherently unstable if they aren't checked by some kind of balancing loop eventually. Think about a snowball rolling downhill. It gets bigger, which makes it roll faster, which makes it pick up more snow, getting even bigger.
Exponential growth or decline?
Precisely. The stock market bubble is a textbook example. Prices go up, output, which attracts more buyers. Input, pushing prices higher still, attracting even more buyers. It's a self-fueling cycle.
Until it pops.
Until it pops. Or think about social dynamics. If trust starts breaking down in a team, people become less willing to cooperate. That lack of cooperation, output, then further erodes trust, input, leading to more withdrawal. It's a downward spiral.
It's really interesting how these simple loop structures explain so much complexity. You mentioned Adam Smith earlier. He wasn't just about the invisible hand, was he?
Not at all. Before Wealth of Nations, he wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And arguably, it's even more fundamental. He was tackling a basic question: how does society even function if people are primarily self-interested?
Yeah, he had that line about how losing your little finger feels worse than hearing about a million strangers dying far away. Pretty stark.
It is, but it highlights his point. We are inherently focused on our own well-being, so why aren't we all just constantly at each other's throats?
So what was his answer?
Feedback. Specifically, the feedback loop of social approval and disapproval. He argued we deeply desire the good opinion of others, and maybe even more importantly, we want the approval of what he called the impartial spectator, that idealized, objective observer inside our own heads, our conscience, perhaps.
So we behave morally, or at least cooperatively, because we anticipate the feedback. We want the praise, we want to avoid the blame, both from others and from ourselves.
That's the core idea. It's a powerful balancing loop, essentially. Our self-interest is balanced by our need for social acceptance and self-regard. This constant feedback guides us towards reciprocity, cooperation, building trust, the foundations of civilization.
And if morality comes from this social feedback, then it's not fixed in stone, is it? It can change as the feedback changes.
Absolutely. Look at historical practices that seem abhorrent to us now. Take infanticide in ancient Greece. It was, for a time, socially accepted, or at least tolerated.
Hard to imagine now.
Right. But over time, the social feedback likely shifted. People reacted less neutrally, maybe expressed more disapproval. Perhaps religious or philosophical ideas changed the impartial spectator's view. As that negative feedback grew, the practice slowly became unacceptable, then unthinkable. The loop dynamics changed the moral norm.
That really highlights how crucial it is to understand these loops. Because if you don't see them, you can fall into traps.
The most common trap. Solving an immediate problem in a way that creates a reinforcing loop that makes the problem worse long term.
Ah, the classic example here is the kidnapping dilemma, isn't it?
Yes, textbook case. A government, or maybe a company, faces a crisis. Someone's been kidnapped. The pressure to do something now is immense. The suffering is immediate.
So, the seemingly obvious solution is pay the ransom. Get the person back safely.
Right. And in the short term, it works. You've balanced the immediate crisis. The suffering stops for that individual case. Problem solved, right?
Not.
But what message did paying send? What's the feedback to the kidnappers? It's crystal clear. This works. Kidnapping is profitable. Do it again.
So paying the ransom actually incentivizes more kidnapping in the future. You've kicked off a reinforcing loop.
Exactly. The short-term fix creates a much bigger escalating long-term problem. It's a vicious cycle.
This must come up in legal thinking too, right? When courts decide on liability or set precedents.
Very much so. Good legal systems often try to think systemically. They don't just look backward to figure out who was at fault for the current harm. They also look forward.
Right.
They ask, what ruling, what precedent will create feedback that makes future suffering less likely? It's about designing the system for better long-term outcomes.
Can you give an example?
Well, sticking with the kidnapping idea, if a court consistently rules that governments cannot pay ransoms and maybe even denies compensation to families in cases where a ransom was refused,
yeah,
that's incredibly harsh for the people affected now.
Devastatingly harsh.
Yes. But the systemic goal is to send unambiguous negative feedback to potential kidnappers to try and break that reinforcing loop by making the act less likely to succeed or be profitable in the future. It's a brutal trade-off.
It really shows the tension between immediate relief and long-term system health.
Yeah.
You have to see the loops to even understand the choice you're making.
Exactly. Every action feeds back. Anticipating those systemic ripples, not just the immediate splash, that's the key.
Okay. So loops drive change, but sometimes change seems stuck, and then suddenly everything shifts.
Yeah.
Which brings us to our next model.
Right. Critical mass. This model describes that moment when a system is poised right on the edge of flipping from one state to a completely different one.
It's where that final tiny input has a massive outsized effect.
Exactly. The classic phrase is the straw that breaks the camel's back. But we often focus only on that final straw.
Yeah. We tend to ignore All the straws that were piled on before, the long buildup, were just impressed by the sudden collapse, the nonlinear shift.
It's like heating water. You put in all that energy getting it from, say, 50 degrees Fahrenheit up to 211, lots of input, but it's still just hot water.
And you add that tiny bit more energy, just one more degree to 212.
And boom, the whole system changes state. You become steam. That final degree had a disproportionate impact because the system had reached critical mass.
The term itself comes from physics, right?
Yeah.
Nuclear reaction.
Yeah, it's the minimum amount of fissile material needed to sustain a nuclear chain reaction. Once you hit that mass, the reaction becomes self-sustaining. It's a perfect metaphor for social and political change, too.
Let's make this concrete. How does this play out in, say, a social movement? You mentioned women's suffrage in New Zealand earlier.
Yes, a fantastic example. New Zealand was the first self-governing country to grant women the vote back in 1893. But this absolutely did not happen overnight. It was a textbook case of building towards critical mass over decades.
So what were the straws being piled on? What was the groundwork?
Several factors. First, the context. New Zealand was a relatively young settler society. There was an element of wanting to build a better, fairer society than the old world they'd left. Mm. Plus, the population was small then, under 750,000 people.
Fewer minds to change, perhaps. Easier to reach a tipping point.
Potentially, yes. Fewer entrenched institutions, maybe. But the really crucial underlying factor, the slow accumulation, was education.
How so?
Thanks to reformers like Learmonth Dalrymple, girls started getting the same secondary education as boys. This was quite progressive for the time. By the 1880s and 90s, women weren't just attending university. They made up nearly half the student body in some years.
Wow, so this educational parity was building a foundation.
A massive one. It gave women the skills, organizational skills, communication skills, confidence, and crucially, a new perspective on their rights and capabilities. It wasn't just about voting, it was about seeing themselves as equal participants in society. This slowly shifted what was considered possible, what was acceptable to even discuss the Overton window, you could call it.
So education was laying the groundwork, increasing the potential energy of the system. Who provided the final push?
The key figure was Kate Sheppard. She led the main suffrage campaign and faced years of setbacks, failed bills. She knew they needed more than just good arguments. They needed to demonstrate undeniable, widespread support to finally tip the balance in Parliament.
So how does she show that?
In 1893, they organized a massive petition, not just a few names, but a huge scroll containing over 32,000 signatures from women across the country. That was roughly a quarter of the entire adult European female population at the time.
That's incredible mobilization.
It was the physical manifestation of critical mass. They literally unrolled this enormous petition down the center aisle of Parliament. It was undeniable proof that this wasn't a fringe idea anymore. It had broad public backing.
And that was the final straw?
It appears so. The bill passed, but only just barely by two votes in the upper house. That final visible demonstration of mass support, built on decades of educational and organizational groundwork, pushed it over the edge. The system flipped.
Amazing story. It shows critical mass isn't just about the final moment, but the long, often invisible accumulation.
Exactly. And this applies not just to social movements, but to physical systems too, like cities.
Ah, cities as complex adaptive systems. Planners often try to engineer them, but sometimes miss what actually makes them work.
Right. The great urban thinker Jane Jacobs was all about this. She argued that the lifeblood of a city isn't necessarily the big infrastructure, projects the highways, the giant parks in isolation. It's the interactions between people.
The human element.
Yes. And for those interactions to reach a critical mass, to become self-sustaining, you need density and diversity. Think about a simple city street. What makes it feel alive and safe?
Lots of people around, maybe. Shops, cafes, people walking.
Exactly. Jacobs called it eyes on the street. Not formal surveillance, but the natural oversight that comes from having many people using the space for different reasons at different times.
So you need shops open during the day, residents coming home in the evening,
yeah.
Maybe cafes or theaters drawing people at night.
Precisely. You need that mix, that density of uses, to ensure there's always enough activity, enough eyes to reach a critical mass of natural surveillance and social interaction. A street with just one type of use, like only offices, becomes deserted and potentially unsafe after 5 p.m. It hasn't achieved that critical mass of diverse activity.
Is there a good example of this working in practice?
Copenhagen's Strøg and pedestrian zone is often cited. When they created it in the 1960s, linking several streets together, critics were skeptical. They said Danes won't use it, especially not in the cold. They're not aliens.
They thought the culture wouldn't support it.
Right. But the planners did something smart. They didn't just make it a path for walking. They ensured it was packed with a diverse range of destinations. High-end shops, everyday stores, cafes, restaurants, access to public squares, places for street performers.
So lots of different reasons for different people to be there at different times.
Exactly. They engineered the conditions for critical mass. By providing a high density of varied uses, they ensured enough people would be present throughout the day and evening, creating that self-sustaining buzz of activity, that feeling of safety and vibrancy, even in winter. It reached critical mass and became a huge success.
So the lesson is, you don't necessarily need to change everything. You need to identify and foster the key elements that allow a system to reach its own tipping point, its own self-sustaining reaction.
Well put. But what happens when a system, even one running well, hits a limit? That takes us to our third model.
Okay, bottlenecks. This seems straightforward, like a traffic jam. But you mentioned there's an important distinction to make first.
Yes, absolutely crucial. We need to differentiate between a constraint and a bottleneck. They're often used interchangeably, but in systems thinking, they mean different things.
Okay, what's the difference?
A constraint is a fundamental limit of the system itself, something you really can't change, or at least not easily. Think laws of physics, the speed of light, the fact that there are only 24 hours in a day. These are hard limits you have to work within.
Got it. Constraints are the walls of the playground. So what's a bottleneck?
A bottleneck is a specific point in a process or system where the flow is restricted, slowing everything else down, but, and this is key, it's potentially alleviable. It's a limit you can address.
Like a slow machine on an assembly line.
Yeah.
Or not having enough cashiers at the supermarket checkout.
Exactly. Or a key person being overloaded with approvals, or a shortage of a specific raw material. It's the point that dictates the overall throughput of this system. Fix the bottleneck, and the whole system can potentially speed up.
Until you hit the next bottleneck.
Precisely. Systems often have a series of bottlenecks. You solve one, and another part of the system becomes the new limiting factor. But the real danger isn't just hitting bottlenecks, it's how you try to fix them.
Back to unintended consequences.
Always. Fixing a bottleneck carelessly, especially by just throwing resources at it without thinking systemically, can create new, sometimes much worse, problems downstream.
You have an example for this one, too.
A really dramatic one. The construction of the Trans-Siberian Railway, the TSR.
Wow, that was an epic undertaking. Over 9,000 kilometers across Siberia.
Colossal. Built mostly between 1891 and 1916, across incredibly difficult terrain, permafrost, thousands of miles from supply centers, the sheer scale is hard to grasp, and the primary political pressure from the start was speed. Finish it fast.
So urgency was baked in. What was the first major bottleneck they hit?
Labor. A massive, massive shortage of workers willing and able to work in those brutal remote conditions. Getting enough manpower to the right places at the right time was the initial critical bottleneck holding back progress.
Okay, makes sense. So how did they try to fix it?
The way governments often try to fix things quickly. They threw money at it. They offered extremely high payments to contractors, basically paying them whatever it took to overcome the labor shortage and get boots on the ground.
So they addressed the labor bottleneck directly with cash. Did it work?
It worked in the sense that it got more workers out there. But here's where the system dynamics bite back. This huge influx of cash, aimed solely at solving the labor bottleneck, combined with rushed timelines and minimal oversight out in the wilds of Siberia. It created a devastating new bottleneck.
Which was?
Materials and quality. The contractors, incentivized primarily to meet deadlines and manage labor costs, which were now sky high, started cutting corners everywhere else. They skimped massively on materials ballast for the track bed, quality of rail, strength of bridges. Supervision was almost non-existent.
Oh, no. So the money meant to speed things up actually undermined the whole project.
Fundamentally, they built the railway incredibly quickly, fulfilling that initial goal. But the end product was, in many sections, dangerously substandard. Embankments were too narrow and unstable. Gradients were too steep. Curves were too sharp for trains to navigate safely or efficiently.
So the solution to the labor bottleneck practically destroyed the integrity of the entire system.
Exactly. It's a perfect, albeit tragic, example of how focusing narrowly on relieving one pressure point without considering the downstream effects can lead to systemic failure. They transferred the bottleneck from labor to quality, and the consequences were severe. The railway needed massive, costly repairs almost immediately.
A powerful warning. But bottlenecks aren't always bad news, are they? Sometimes they force creativity.
Absolutely. They can be the greatest spur to innovation. When you hit a hard limit, when the usual way is blocked, that's when real breakthroughs often happen. Necessity is the mother of invention, as they say.
Where have we seen this play out?
Wartime is often a catalyst because it creates intense resource bottlenecks. Think back to World War I. Blockades caused severe food shortages in Germany and other central powers. This led to widespread nutritional deficiencies, including rickets in children.
Rickets, the bone disease from lack of vitamin D, right? Which you normally get from sunlight or certain foods.
Correct. So the bottleneck was the lack of vitamin D-rich foods like cod liver oil or eggs. People couldn't get enough through diet.
So how did they solve it? Find substitute foods.
That was difficult. But a Berlin doctor, Kurt Holtschinsky, noticed something interesting. He saw that children exposed to the strong ultraviolet light from quartz mercury vapor lamps seemed to get better. He started treating children with rickets by basically giving them artificial sunlight sessions.
And it worked?
It worked remarkably well. The UV light stimulated the children's bodies to produce their own vitamin D, effectively bypassing the dietary bottleneck.
That's brilliant. He didn't find more of the missing resource. He found a different pathway to the needed outcome.
Exactly. He solved the nutritional bottleneck without solving the food bottleneck. It was a conceptual leap driven by the constraint.
We saw something similar in World War II with rubber, didn't we?
Yes, another critical wartime bottleneck. When Japan conquered Southeast Asia, the Allies lost access to about 90% of the world's natural rubber supply.
And rubber was essential for everything. Tires for trucks and planes, seals, wiring insulation.
Absolutely critical. The war effort could have ground to a halt. This massive bottleneck triggered an unprecedented crash program in the U.S. to develop synthetic rubber.
Led by chemists like Waldo Simon.
Right. And the pressure was immense. But they succeeded. They rapidly scaled up production of synthetic alternatives like Buda S rubber. By 1944, the U.S. was producing huge quantities, more than making up for the lost natural supply.
And that innovation fundamentally changed the rubber industry forever, didn't it?
Yeah.
We still rely heavily on synthetics.
Permanently. The bottleneck forced a complete transformation of the materials science in the industry. It shows how bottlenecks, while painful, often reveal the most critical leverage points in a system and force us to find entirely new solutions.
They point to where innovation is most needed and most valuable. Okay, so we've seen how systems change, how they tip over, and how they hit limits. What about long-term growth and success? That brings us to the last model.
Yes, compounding. This is arguably the most powerful force in the universe, if you believe Einstein, or at least in finance and personal development.
It's that snowball effect again, but hopefully in a positive direction this time.
Exactly. Compounding is about making progress. And then this is the crucial part, reinvesting the gains from that progress to generate even more gains in the future. It leads to exponential growth over long timelines.
We understand it with money interest earning interest, but it applies much more broadly.
Oh, far more broadly. But we often struggle with it intuitively, don't we? Our brains tend to think linearly. We expect steady, incremental progress.
Right. Double something. Okay, double it again. Fine. But when it starts doubling repeatedly, the numbers get huge, incredibly fast, and it feels counterintuitive.
That's the nature of the exponential curve. The really dramatic growth happens towards the end of the period. Small, consistent efforts early on seem insignificant, but they lay the foundation for massive returns later. It's why starting early, whether investing money or learning a skill, is so powerful.
Let's talk about compounding knowledge. You had a fascinating historical example.
Yes, looking at Jewish history. Around the first century CE, there was a significant religious ordinance passed that essentially mandated universal primary education for boys. Fathers were obligated to send their sons to school to learn literacy, primarily to read the Torah.
That must have been extraordinary at a time when literacy was rare for the vast majority of people globally.
It was a massive society-wide investment in human capital, and the payoff wasn't immediate. For generations, they were largely an agricultural or pastoral people, like many others.
But then circumstances changed.
Drastically. Following various conflicts and dispersions, particularly into medieval Europe, they found themselves often barred from owning land or joining craft guilds. They became a largely urban population.
And that's where the literacy paid off.
Hugely. In a world where maybe 90-95% of the population was illiterate peasantry, suddenly you have a community where male literacy is near universal. What can literate people do in cities?
Well, they can read contracts, keep accounts, manage trade, lend money, engage in scholarship, skills valuable in commerce and finance.
Exactly. That centuries-long compounding investment in literacy gave them a significant comparative advantage in precisely those urban occupations that were becoming increasingly important. They could fill economic niches that required reading, writing, and numeracy, which were closed off to the largely illiterate majority.
It created options generations later that couldn't possibly have been predicted when the original investment was made.
That's the essence of compounding knowledge or skills. You invest today, consistently, and it creates opportunities decades down the line that are impossible to foresee now.
It's not just about knowledge in books, either. Experience compounds, too, right? If you learn from it.
Absolutely. The key, again, is reinvestment. You have to consciously take the lessons, the feedback from one experience, and apply it to make the next one better. Think about someone like Maria Mayer, the explorer and wildlife correspondent.
Known for going into really remote, tough environments.
Exactly. And her success wasn't down to some innate toughness gene. It was the result of compounding experience. She talks about her first major expedition.
Assuming mistakes.
Oh, yeah. She admits she packed completely wrong, brought a teddy bear backpack because it looked cute, wore trendy boots that fell apart. Classic beginner errors.
We've all been there in some domain.
Right. But the difference is she didn't just shrug it off. She learned. She meticulously cataloged what worked, what didn't, what gear failed, what skills she lacked. She took that feedback and deliberately reinvested it in preparing for the next trip.
So each expedition built on the last one.
Exponentially. Years later, she's this ultra-efficient, minimalist expert. She knows exactly what tiny, non-obvious things to pack like a small mirror, not for vanity, but for signaling aircraft in an emergency. That mastery came from systematically compounding the lessons learned from every single trip, especially the early clumsy ones.
That's a great illustration of reinvesting experience. Now, compounding also shows up in networks and relationships, doesn't it? There's a term for that.
Preferential attachment. It's a core concept in network science. Basically, it means that assets, whether it's wealth, fame, connections, followers, tend to flow to those who already have more of them.
The rich get richer. Or the popular get more popular.
Exactly. It's a compounding effect in social and economic networks. Success breeds success, often exponentially. Think about how websites with more links tend to attract even more links, making them more visible, which attracts more links.
It explains why we see such skewed distributions in wealth and influence sometimes. Small initial advantages can snowball.
They really can. And it highlights the importance of building and nurturing your network. Consider the story of Sidney Weinberg.
The longtime head of Goldman Sachs.
That's him. He ran the firm for decades, advised presidents. But his start was anything but privileged. He began at Goldman Sachs in 1907 as a janitor's assistant, earning $3 a week. Barely any formal education.
That's an almost unbelievable rise. How did he do it?
He had an almost uncanny ability to build and crucially leverage relationships. He made himself indispensable, first through sheer hard work, then by cultivating connections with colleagues, clients, everyone.
He invested in his network.
Continuously and strategically. As he rose, he made a point of serving on corporate boards. At his peak, he sat on the boards of over 30 major American companies, simultaneously Ford, General Electric, Kraft, you name it.
That's an incredible number of connections.
And each connection compounded the value of the others. Being on the Ford board gave him insights and influence that helped him on the GE board, and vice versa. It gave him unparalleled access to information, deal flow, and opportunities. He consciously reinvested his time and energy into expanding and strengthening his network, and that network compounded to give him immense power and influence far beyond what his initial station would suggest.
It shows relationships aren't just static things. They're assets that can compound if you actively manage them.
Absolutely. Though the flip side of preferential attachment is that initial disadvantages can also compound, making it harder for those starting behind to catch up. It's why things like access to good early education or social safety nets are seen by some as balancing loops against runaway inequality.
Right. But the underlying principle holds. Sustained effort plus reinvestment equals exponential results over time. Whether it's money, knowledge, experience, or relationships.
That's the power of compounding. #... outro.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground here. Feedback loops, critical mass, bottlenecks, compounding. Four powerful mental models. What's the big takeaway? How should we use these?
Well, the big takeaway is that these models provide a kind of language, a toolkit, for understanding the hidden dynamics of almost any situation you encounter. They help you look beneath the surface events.
So instead of just seeing, say, a company struggling, you can ask, is there a reinforcing loop driving down morale? Is there a critical bottleneck in their production process? Are they failing to compound their early successes?
Exactly. It shifts your perspective from just reacting to diagnosing the underlying structure. And once you can diagnose the structure, you have a much better chance of finding effective leverage points for change or anticipating where things might go next.
It helps you design better solutions, maybe avoid those unintended consequences we talked about with the Trans-Siberian Railway.
Hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you a framework to ask better questions. Am I creating a reinforcing loop here? Have we truly reached critical mass for this initiative, or is more groundwork needed? Where is the real bottleneck holding us back? Am I consistently reinvesting my knowledge and experience?
It's about thinking systemically.
That's the essence of it. Now, we want to leave you with one final mental model to consider, something that kind of ties into making sense of all this complexity. It's the idea of irreducibility.
Irreducibility. Okay, what does that mean?
It prompts you to ask, what is the absolute minimum core of something that's needed for it to still function or still be recognizable as itself? What are the truly essential elements stripped of everything else?
Finding the essence.
Exactly. Think about Einstein's famous quote, something like, everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. The goal is to find that irreducible core.
How might you apply that?
Well, say you're trying to communicate a complex idea. Ask yourself, what is the irreducible message here? Have I added too many qualifications, too much jargon that obscures the core point? Can I strip it back to its simplest, most powerful form?
Or in building a product or a team.
Same question. What is the irreducible set of features this product must have to deliver its core value? What is the irreducible minimum team size or skill set needed to achieve our primary goal? Anything beyond that might be adding complexity or cost without adding proportional value.
So it's about finding the elegant minimum, the most efficient expression of function or idea.
Precisely. By constantly asking what can be removed, you force yourself to identify what is truly essential. And focusing your energy and resources on that irreducible core is often the most leveraged thing you can do. It's the ultimate application of finding simplicity on the other side of complexity.
Find the irreducible core. That's a great thought to leave our listeners with. Something to mull over.
Hopefully a useful final tool for your mental toolkit.